It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper back with you, 32 minutes past 1 o'clock. He's a poet, playwright, and novelist, a Miami-based Jamaican writer who's juggled genres in half a dozen books. He's Jeffrey Philp, and his themes remain constant: growing up fatherless, the inescapable influence of religion, South Florida's transnational identity, and the racial and economic divisions that afflict the post-colonial Caribbean. In his new work, 12 Poems and a Story for Christmas is a seasonal addition to his work, and he tells Topical Currents literary interviewer Ariel Gonzalez why he chose a Christmas-themed book.
The story of Christmas is something that we've all grown up with, and I wanted to pursue imaginatively the viewpoints of all of these various characters and perhaps to give a new twist on a very, very old story.
Okay, but from looking at it from different points of view, you can certainly bring up different perspectives.
Yes.
And it's almost like a Rashomon effect.
Okay.
And so I was just curious, because was there any particular reason why you decided to look at it from these different points of view? Because you could have expanded it.
Yes.
And looked at it from other points of view as well. Why did you choose these points of view particularly?
Well, how the book evolved was 18 years ago, my daughter, I was going to be separated from my family at Christmas. Mm-hmm. So the book has really evolved over these past 18 years. So in a way, there was a design, but in another way, there wasn't. This is really a culmination of all of these 18 years of writing Christmas poems and then choosing the best 12.
And that's an interesting number, 12.
Yes, because again, you know, 12 days of Christmas,
of course,
you know, this sort of magical effects associated with the number 12 and everything else.
Right. Okay. Well, you pay particular attention to Joseph, a minor character who is often neglected or shunted aside. Why are you intrigued by him?
One of the reasons why I'm intrigued by Joseph is that Joseph is his father figure. Uncommon in Caribbean literature, uncommon in Black literature. And this father figure for me, especially coming out of the history that we've had within the Caribbean and within the African diaspora experience, Joseph intrigues me in that he was bringing up a child that was not his own.
Right.
And the whole relationship between a father and a son is one of those themes that has informed my literature, informed my writing, because given this situation in Jamaica and indeed the Caribbean, many of us, including myself, were brought up by surrogate fathers. And so one of the questions that I've asked myself personally and also in my writing is, what does it mean to be a father? What does it mean to be a man? And Joseph, for me, answers this question. He was a carpenter. He was a man who had a discipline. He was a man who had a craft. He was a man who faithfully went about his duties as a man, as a father, and that is what I try to be.
That's interesting, because Joseph, I think you mentioned that he's God's cuckold.
Yes.
And you know, he isn't really paid attention to that much, because people pray to Mary, they pray to Jesus, but I never heard of anybody praying to Joseph.
Well, this is my prayer to Joseph, because there are times when you need a role model, you need a hero like Joseph to take you through the times, as I said, when you think the Romans have you on the run, and that is when you really need someone that at least you hold in your imagination strongly and firmly, and you say, if this is what I want to be, then how do I how do I behave in this way? And I think this, the imagination is what heals many of us. By following the imagination, by intuitively following the clues that our imagination gives us, we can come out to a sort of more rounded sense of who and what we are.
Recently, I don't know if you watched The Simpsons, they had a Christmas episode.
No.
And Homer played a disgruntled Joseph, who, and they called themselves a non-traditional family. So,
I haven't seen it, but again, it's that, because ultimately, every family will face some kind of trouble. And whether you're traditional or non-traditional, who and what you are is shaped by many things. And if you have no guide, then, you know, but it's also, Homer Simpson is a very, very, for me, and I didn't see that one, but Homer Simpson is a very, very interesting character in that if you follow the evolution of the father in cinema, in also in television, I mean, we've gone from Father Knows Best.
Right.
To Homer.
Yes.
I mean, and even more interesting now, Family Guy.
Okay.
So, you know, the whole role of the father in television is a very, very, I mean, you look at even that brief time where you had Bill Cosby. Here's another father figure.
Right.
You couldn't really call him a father figure as such, but Ralph Camden. So all of these males who have played, I'm sure there's an interesting paper out there to be written on the evolution, or perhaps the de-evolution of the father in American television.
Right.
Because, the gaps now between Father Knows Best and Family Guy.
Yes.
How did we get here?
Sure.
How did we get to that point?
Well, continuing with that idea of fatherlessness or fatherhood, which you've mentioned is central to your work.
Yes.
And you said that it reflects a certain social condition in Jamaica.
Yes.
What is the reason for that condition, you think?
Part of the whole outgrowth of these conditions is, number one, the family structure was splintered in the African diaspora, and families were broken up and everything else during slavery and the ensuing time. So there isn't really this tradition within the Jamaican family. In fact, a woman, I forget her name now, wrote a book called My Mother Who Fathered Me. And basically, Jamaica and many Caribbean countries follow this sort of matriarchal tradition, if you want to call it. Because again, economics and everything else, the fathers come to Belgrade, the fathers come to Florida, the fathers go to New York, wherever,
right,
and send money back to the islands, and so the father is often absent for one reason or another. The Jamaican Caribbean male is often absent from the family, and so as a result of that, many of the boys, many of the children who grew up within family, the mother is really both mother and father.
Oh, okay.
So there isn't, there again, this is one of the things that I'm trying to do within the literature, to at least address this issue that has been important to me, but also I think it's important within the family to restore the position of the father. So at least, again, imaginatively, the youngsters and the people who read my work can at least have an idea, and it will also point to other things within the literature, within the broad scope, let us say, of literature, that here is this, this is what I think a father or a man should be.
Okay, great. In addition to fatherlessness, I noticed that religion is an enduring presence in your writing.
Yes.
Many writers have incorporated religion into their work, of course. One could argue that literature wouldn't exist without religion.
Of course.
What role has faith or religion played in the development of your creative imagination?
Well, I was brought up within a very strict fundamentalist family. My mother was a Seventh-day Adventist, and she became a Jehovah's Witness. And in the midst of all of that, I was surrounded by the Rastafarians and the music of Bob Marley. Within all of that, I've had to sort my own religious faith, my own beliefs out. But one of the things that the Rastafarians, and especially Bob Marley, did for me, I had a sort of life-changing experience. And I mean that. I was in Jamaica. It was about 1974. Bob Marley's Natty Dread seemed to be playing on every single station. And I was walking to see a friend of mine. And as I was walking up Geranium, Plumbago, Bob Marley was singing like on every... And I walked up the first street, the second street. And so that moment was when I realized this is the power of art. It's similar to, you know, that fourth chapter in Portrait of the Artist when James Joyce as Stephen Dedalus sees the girl in the water. It's that same kind of moment where you're inhabiting your world and the world of the artist at the same time. And at that moment I realized this is what art does. So reading Portrait at that time, listening to Bob Marley, sort of crystallized that sort of what is the role of the artist within the religious imagination. And I just went, wow, now I know what I want to do. I want to write, maybe not as well as James Joyce, but I do know I want to write.
So Bob Marley was responsible for your Road to Damascus moment.
Yes. Yes, very much so, because at that moment I realized this is what an artist does. This is what the role of the artist within the imagination.
But now we're going to have to take a break, so we'll be right back in just a moment.
Friends of WLRN is proud to present David Sedaris, one of today's top essayists. Santa Len Diaries, the strange but true account of his job as a Macy's elf, was featured on NPR's Morning Edition. David's witty works are regularly featured in The New Yorker and Esquire magazines, as well as on This American Life with Ira Glass. David Sedaris performs live 8 p.m. Friday, April 14th at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets on sale now at browardcenter.org, as well as all Ticketmaster locations, online, and charged by phone.
This is Ariel Gonzalez, and here we are with A Topical Current with Jeffrey Philp, novelist, playwright, and short story writer. And we're talking about his new book, 12 Poems and a Story for Christmas. Jeffrey, the story in this book takes place in Miami. Its hero, a Jamaican man married to a Haitian woman, is in a desperate situation, both spiritually and materially. What inspired this story, and what advantages, if any, do you think a Miami-based writer enjoys?
Well, I've often said that the hardest thing that one can do as an artist is to describe what's happening outside your window. And so I really don't want to be caught up in slave narratives. I really don't want to be caught up in things that have happened in the past, because I'm not interested in reliving past traumas.
Okay.
So I set myself this task. I had an original vision of writing this story. I saw Christmas. I saw this man going through the door, but I didn't know why he was going through the door on Christmas Day. And so I started to go back and develop a whole backstory on this man. And I found out that he was a musician. I went, okay, well, what does his wife do? And I looked across and there was a wife. And I looked at her a little bit more. I I've recognized her. I went, oh, she's, her name is Marie, and developed a whole backstory on her. I saw the child that he was leaving behind develop. And out of this, again, it's just working from the intuition, working from the little clues that because I don't set out to write stories. I get a glimpse of something happening,
uh-huh.
and I go, let me pay attention to this. I pay attention to it a little more, and suddenly these characters start to emerge, and I really do listen to them. And then I get this thing, and I look at it, and it's in the rewrite now that I begin to shape it, and I go, okay, I understand what's happening here. And then I show it to my friends like the writer Preston Allen, and I show it to my boss, Josette Pete, and they both help me to shape this thing out, and I go, okay. And most of the times it's someone like Preston, or indeed Preston, who says to me, this is a bit obscure here. You need to flesh that out. So my friends and my other writers really help me with once I think I'm finished with it, then we look at the whole story, and then we look at what is the meaning of the event, because an experience really doesn't mean anything until you've reflected upon it, and that is what I do. So therefore, here comes the whole Christmas experience. What would the Christmas experience mean within a Miami context?
Well, that's true. And again, being a Miami-based writer,
yes,
you're exposed to different cultures.
Yes.
So would that help to enrich and enhance your writing?
It certainly has. I mean, I came here April 30th, 1979, and I didn't want to come here. But my mother sold the house, and she said, well, what are you going to do now? So she was already in Miami, and she said, I expect to see you here in 30 days. And so I came to Miami. I had expected to spend my whole life in Jamaica. But once I came here, and then I started, again, reflecting upon what was happening to me. That was how that first book, Florida Bound, came about.
Okay.
Actually, there was a book before that called Exodus and Other Poems. Again, Exodus, the biblical, but one of Bob Marley's LPs at that time was called Exodus. So again, you know, even from those earlier times, it's this balancing of my own religious ideas. Because as I wrote in one of my pieces, Jamaicans are people of the book. We look at our experiences through the prism of the Bible. And so, I mean, even with the Rastafarians, with, you know, by the rivers of Babylon, the Israelites, the whole Rastafarian experience is informed by the Bible. But I'm not a Rastafarian. If anything, as I've explained to one of my friends, I see myself probably as a secular Rastafarian, as one of the roles. And one of the roles of a secular Rastafarian is our definitions, if you want to call it that, is someone who accepts some of the basic tenets of Rastafarianism, but does not accept the divinity of Haile Selassie, the ex-emperor of Ethiopia, which is the main tenet of Rastafarianism.
Right, yes. Yeah, I've heard that.
Yes. So, the other tenets, not seeing oneself as an object, which was the whole experience of slavery. Slavery and colonialism turned black people into objects, into things that could be bought and sold. Rastafarianism rejects all of that, which is why they say I, man. And everything becomes I, filtered through, you know, that I, in other words, I am always a subject, never an object. And so it crushes, it dissolves that whole idea that that we can be bought and sold anymore. And so that for me was very empowering, because no longer was the Caribbean being viewed as, or people from the Caribbean being, are we being viewed as commodities and things to be exploited, which is why I don't write slave narratives, because I'm not interested anymore in that whole exploitation thing. I would rather us begin again, you know, as Bob says, a new wine, you know, of seeing oneself as, and not accepting victim status.
Right.
I don't believe in the victim status thing.
Right.
So therefore, if you reject all of that, then everything becomes new.
I don't know if you're familiar with Martin Buber's book, I and Thou.
Yes.
Yes, because you mentioned the rejection of objectification.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, Buber may have much in common with Rastafarianism.
Yeah, and but the difference between Buber and Rastafarianism is that Rastafarianism is growing out of a mystical tradition, which Buber doesn't. The divine is still something that can only be addressed. Whereas with the Rastafarians, with I and I, one merges, and so it dissolves. At the one time, it acknowledges the duality, but at the same time, it dissolves that whole intellectual schism between oneself and the divine. Hmm. So by saying I and I, one has a union, but at the same time, the dissolution of the seemingly disparate chasm between man and God.
Good. You've written about feeling pressured by editors and publishers to tone down Jamaican dialect in your books. How far should a writer from another country go to find acceptance in the mainstream American market?
Well, the bottom line in book selling is you have to sell books.
Right.
So,
sure.
So,
it's a business.
So it's a business. As far as the toning down, again, because of the Rastafarian experience, because of the whole history of Jamaicans, which is to have a language of resistance, I feel as an artist that I need to honor that tradition. And so my language, my writing will continue that language of resistance, not wanting to sound like the slave master, not wanting to sound like the colonialist. So we have this thing called nation language, or the patois, wherein we balance the whole thing. Again, you have to sell books. So it's this constant tightrope that I'm walking. On the one hand, the need to sell books, but on the other hand, to honor the traditions of Jamaicans and people within the diaspora.
Right. Because other writers, Nabokov comes to mind.
Yes.
Who came to America when he was 40.
Yes.
And had already written several novels in Russian.
Yes.
But knew that he had to write in English.
Yes.
Or Joseph Conrad.
Yes. And masters of the English language.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But again, but they did not have, again, they did not have the relationship with English that I have. Mm. You know, if you look at even James Joyce's writing, my feeling with the English language is similar to, remember in that short story by James Joyce, The Dead?
Yes.
That's the sort of relationship that I have with English. You know, it's on the one hand, it's a language of the master, but at the same time, you know, and it's that whole tension that was going on there. And the woman finally says to him, but, you know, you write for this right-wing newspaper, this English newspaper.
Right.
What are you doing? And you're saying you're Irish? Well, in the same way, those are the same voices that come into my head. You say you're Jamaican.
Divided loyalties.
Divided loyalties.
Right. It's sort of like Caliban.
Yes.
The Tempest.
Of course. That's a whole...
That's a whole different thing entirely, yes. Okay. And this book, to steal a phrase from Mary McCarthy's review of Nabokov's Pale Fire, is a centaur work. It's half poetry, half fiction.
Yes.
And you write both poetry and fiction, of course. Is there one that you prefer, or is it all the same to you?
It all depends on how the idea goes and what comes to me and how I should do it. And, you know, wherever the spirit leads me, that's where I go.
The Christmas spirit.
The Christmas spirit.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jeffrey Philp, the author of 12 Poems and a Story for Christmas. This is Ariel Gonzalez for Topical Currents.
And that's our program for today. Technical supervision by Michael Stock. Associate producer is Richard Ives. Our address remains the same. That's info@wlrn.org. info@wlrn.org. Telephone area code 305-995-2258. CDs and audio cassettes are available. Audio archives at wlrn.org. Tomorrow's Topical Currents looks at Haiti and what looks like yet another postponement of national elections. Political and criminal violence and instability have continued. We'll also learn about cultural exchanges in Haiti. And now our all-world figure calendar for December 26th, Boxing Day. On this day in 1492, 513 years ago, Christopher Columbus establishes Spain's first colony in the Americas on Hispaniola in what is now Haiti. Also on this day in 1893, 112 years ago, the birth of Mao Zedong, founding father of the People's Republic of China, established in 1949. He ruled until his death in 1976. And one more while we ponder the buck stops here. On this day in 1972, 33 years ago, the death of Harry S. Truman, 33rd president at age 88 in Independence, Missouri. Before entering politics, he was a lieutenant colonel in World War I. And we leave you with thoughts from Truman after a bad review of his daughter's singing. Quote, "I have read your lousy review of Margaret's concert. Someday I hope to meet you. When that happens, you'll need a new nose, a lot of beefsteak for black eyes, and perhaps a supporter below." Give him hell, Harry. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned next for Neil Conan and the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor with a Prairie Hump Companion. Winter is coming to the frozen tundra, and so we're heading down to South Florida for a live broadcast at Miami's Bayfront Park Amphitheater, Saturday, February.